Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for ranks, flanks, and kings of war. Join your hosts as they delve into the world of Panathar and bring you worldwide coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Rob Fanuff.
I'm Jeremy Duvall.
And I'm Matt Croger. Welcome to our November monthly fireside, recording a little later than usual. Rob, I'm sure you'll do your editing wizardry and have this out probably within days. Good to have the band back together. Jeremy, good to have you back at home and hopefully getting a little bit of rest now and back amongst us.
Yeah, it's been a crazy month for me. Many of you have seen or heard. Beginning of October was an awesome family vacation to Hawaii, which we had a great time. And then as soon as I was back from that, the next day I was on a plane to Texas to spend a couple weeks. My mom had a stroke, but she's recovering, but I wanted to spend some time. So I essentially haven't been working or at home for the entire month of October. So it's been, I'm just getting back now to no emails at all at work after not being gone for a month. So it's going to take me half as long as I've been gone probably to get caught up at work, but very excited to be back. It was great to see my mom. Hawaii was great, but definitely the siren sing-song call of my hobby table has been slithering into my mind space now, so I'm excited to be back.
Especially when we're at such a new, sparkly hobby space, mate.
Still has the new car smell, you know? I haven't really been able to mess around with it too much. How have you guys been doing?
Pretty good. Work stuff's been busy, so I haven't get as much hobby done. We'll talk about that in a minute, but life's good. I mean, I'm really looking forward to the holidays and just kind of recharge the batteries because we got a big year in 2025.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, me too. I'll just think, I can't believe we've got 8 weeks until 8 weeks until Christmas, essentially. Everything seems to be happening all at once, but yeah, we'll get there.
We joke about it, right? First world problems. Very much so, of like, oh, I'm so busy spending time with my family and playing with all my new toys and models and, you know, oh, I have so much to do. Lots of stuff coming up in November. I know for me, we have the Reno Jackalopes tournament on November 23-24. So that's the Reno crew. They're hosting their fall tournament, which is pretty cool. It comes where you get to select two different types of special creatures to fight alongside with you. One is the Jackalope, which is sort of their club name, and then a Voppeltinger or some sort of weird creature. Anyway, you get to pick a special monster to go with you. The interesting thing this time is Nick Murray, who is one of the guys, been on the show before, people in the tournament scene know him. He teaches at University of Nevada in Reno. So we're holding the tournament at one of their university's recreation spaces. So we're starting to outgrow the store that we usually have it in. If you run it in a store, right, you have certain time issues, right? You can only be, you know, running the event when the store's open, or, you know, every store is different, obviously. But I think you run into some logistical issues when you're running an event out of a store space. So we're going to be running it at the university, which lets us start a little earlier, stay a little later. So really excited for that event. I'm heading up there. Britton's coming up from SoCal testing his new army project that if you haven't listened to the latest Scrying Gems, go listen to that. He talks about the new army he's working on, which is going to be super cool. He's coming up. It looks like Rashad is coming out of retirement and maybe heading up too, which will be fun. I think last time I checked, we had 12 or 14 people signed up, which for us, you know, in our scene is good. You know, we're still trying to hit that, you know, that 20 plus for our local events. So pretty excited for that. Masters prep continues. We've been working with the Atlantis Hotel, getting everything finalized. We're going to be sort of our master's committee is we have sub chairs. Like, so essentially part of our planning, we have the chair in charge of terrain, the chair in charge of prize support, the chair in charge of customer relations, our, you know, concierge services. So we're sort of breaking the structure of the event down so that all the things can be covered and so that us as a community can spread the workout. But it looks like I'll be the sort of the areas I'll be focusing on is social media, which makes sense, right? It looks like I'm going to be streaming with Matt Carmack is going to be coming in from Texas. We're working on the final, getting all that logistically planned out. Going to be picking Mike Adkins' brain so that we can have some similar functionality so that if people want to hop in on the stream, they can. But still in the early parts of getting that planned. But we're really excited about it. It's going to be a great event. So we're working through that. And yeah, we're pretty excited. What about you, Matt? What's sort of been on your community docket?
Well, we've got Masters coming up next weekend and the side event. So that's the biggest thing coming up probably for the rest of the year. And then we roll into January with Clash of Kings Australia. So now we've got a reasonable amount signed up for that. So we always can take more. So we've got that and our first firefight tournament in the day after Clash. So we're having a real massive Mantic event. We'll have stuff going both evenings. We'll probably have plate demo games of Dead Zone and Armada and things like that. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to playing in the side event in next weekend. It's going to be good to get a bunch of, our Masters is pretty small at 16 people. And I think the side event's only got about 10. So, but still, 20-something people in the room having a good time will be a great event. I'm really pumped for Clash. So, yeah, that's mostly what's happening with us. What about you, Rob?
We've got Forge GT coming up November 16th and 17th in Homewood, Alabama. They're playing 2,400 points and using Clash of Kings. If you have questions, you can reach out to Nathan Clevenger on Facebook. He's happy to assist. And then we're announcing Kings of Memphis 5, which will be happening in 2025 on June 21st and 22nd. It's our new player-friendly event. We're playing at 2,025 points. You get a free bard character. We're playing with command dice. We're not playing with withdraw or allies. Registration will open in January, and the player pack is on our Facebook page and is in the show notes as well. Jeremy, why don't you take us into the hobby updates? I know you got a lot of stuff going on.
I had originally hoped when I went to Texas, my Northern Alliance army would have been, I would have had it so I could put some stuff together while in Texas, but it didn't make it in time. So instead what I did, I'm like sitting there unable to do hobby stuff. So it's like, I'm planning my display board. I'm buying all my stuff for like my theme. I went to a bunch of game stores in Texas while I was there shopping. So right now, the majority of my hobby focus has been preparing for the theme of my Ice Elf Northern Alliance army. So it's going to be sort of an ice or an elf mountain town at first winter or first snow or, that transition between fall and winter. So I've been getting all the different stuff for that. I'm going to be experimenting with new textures, water effects. I want to do some frozen ponds, looking at fall, winter colors. I got a huge resin 3D print order that's in process coming from the UK. That's a ton of elf buildings, dead trees, fountains, like all this great stuff for my display board. And I was talking with sort of the guru of display boards, especially if not the best, one of the best in the country, definitely the best in the West Coast, is Scott Holcomb. People who haven't seen his pirate board or his Order of the Green Lady / Basilian monastery board. So I've been talking to him because I want to build a high-end board, but I want to build a high-end display board that matches the theme of my army that I can take with me on a plane. Right, that I can take with me to Adepticon or that I can take with me to a Masters that I'm flying. He was giving me some tips and he's like, sometimes if you start with too much of an open palette or an open design is hard. Whereas if you have constraints sometimes can be really useful for design. So I started to think about, okay, I have all these new materials. Like I want to experiment with using XPS foam to make mountains, which I've never really done. Sculpt mold, cork, slate, all these new materials. But I was like, let me think about first, how am I going to transport the board? So I started researching sizes and the standard size seems to be for Southwest, United, all those sort of airlines in the US is a combined size of 62 inches. So that's your length, your width, and your depth. You add all three of those up and does it equal 62? As far as how long or how wide or how deep it can be. There doesn't seem to be as hard limits on that. More, it's more of like, if it's accept, if it's reasonably divided among those three things. But the real main thing is that 62 inch size. So first I started looking at suitcases, right? Well, maybe I'll just buy a suitcase and the suitcase will be like my display board suitcase. But then I started thinking about like band equipment, you know, our trunks, our stuff that's shipped in those traditional, like if you see it, you know it, right? It's the black cases with the metal on the edge with the latches. So I started researching those, and those companies, they're shipping sound equipment, right? Our band equipment. So they're really sturdy, that you can have them within foam built in. So I've been looking at one company that does those cases that will build custom sized cases. So I think I'm just going to get a really solid industrial strength trunk built out to check on an airplane, a display board. And then I'm just going to use that for all my display boards. I'll build them, you know, once I get the one bespoke trunk, then I'll just build future boards to fit in that trunk so that when I'm going to Adepticon or something, or when I finally make it out to Clash Australia or UK, I'm just going to check it as an extra suitcase, you know, build some stuff in there, you know, for buildings, you know, like the buildings won't be attached to the board, but I'll have it in foam in the trunk, you know. So the display board with all the accoutrements will ship in one trunk. I don't know. What do you guys think about that? I think it can be done safely, right? Would you think, Rob, you could, if you have the right thing, you could check a display board and have it survive?
Yeah, you can. I've seen it done. I mean, in fact, I've seen it done where Gibney, one of our local players, would just design a box to put it in. He would ship it to the event and it would just get there and it would be waiting at the hotel. But yeah, I think what you're talking about, like a travel case, a lot of times it's sound equipment, but it could be any kind of precision equipment. You're Mr. Moneybags now, but I would have said that's a pretty expensive road you're traveling down.
It's not for the faint of heart. No, nor is it like, you know how sometimes you build those armies where you want to be budget conscious? This is not one of those projects. Still just have been trying to get to a point to have a up-to-date 95%+ Mantic army that is done at a really high level. We had Bay of Kings recently and Scott brought out one of his massive display boards. And it's just like, if I ever want to compete in my region, it's like the arms race, you know, that I have to go. I mean, I have Scott, I have Brinton, I have all these people in my region that are such amazing hobbyists that it's like, if I want to stay at that level, I got to always be pushing, you know, pushing myself. But yeah, so really excited. I'm picking up today after we record this afternoon. I'm heading over to the Loose Caboose and going to be getting the actual army itself so I can start getting that assembled. I've been playing it on UB. I've got about five or six games in with my build. So far doing pretty good. It's within that plus or minus 10% of design so far, I think, as far as being a pretty good army. And the more that I get it, and I'm curious to hand it over to you, Matt, because I know you've been working on a similar, same faction. But man, I really like Northern Alliance. I think there's a lot of cool stuff in it. My list is a little unique. It's using a lot of the elf elements because that's sort of my theme. But I think there is a lot to love in Northern Alliance, just as far as different types of builds and infantry and snow trolls and ice knight. It's just like the more that I've played it, the more that I've really loved it. But how's your Northern Alliance coming, Matt?
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think it'd be pretty easy, which I think is a feature of good list design, to see, you know, almost every different list I would hope could be a little bit different. So yeah, over the slow grow, I'm literally just highlighting everything I did in the slow grow now that was good enough for that, because I'm taking a bunch of it to the side event for Masters. But yeah, it's easily one that you could have a, you know, 6,000 point collection and be using varieties of all of it every time you put it on the table. I think there's some areas of the synergy that can't quite maximized as well as they could be with that frozen theme. But then, you know, I quite like having Frozen there, even if it's not about synergizing it with Vicious, because I think altering your opponent's speed in a movement game can be just so powerful, particularly even on things like flyers. And so, you know, I've got regiments of ice elementals in my list, a couple of regiments of ice elementals, and, you know, they can push forward as thick chaff and be, getting off some shots, but also just really, you know, altering what your opponent can do in the turn after. So, oh yeah, I'm really loving the play style, and I still think it's kind of, even though the Northern Alliance itself has been out for quite a while, it's not like you're seeing heaps of them on the table. So, which is what I like. I don't like playing armies where there's just, you know, heaps of them turning up. But for me, yeah, I'm working madly on trying to highlight that. There's a special character too. I brought in last year to the side event that they have special characters themed around the previous masters, and they'll have a couple of, you know, cool plus joke rules to pet based on their play style. So doing a model, the special character's called Stephen Devilfish instead of Stephen Devonish in the pack. So, you know, I've got a Trident Realmsy type model that I'm just painting up, but he's got a special rule because there was a little bit of drama over them having to shorten the games unexpectedly, and that worked against Stephen. So he's got a special rule that while he's alive, you know, you get 5 extra minutes on your clock, but if he dies, that 5 minutes is removed. So I'm putting a removable clock on his base too, which is, yeah, it's all going to be a bit of fun. And then Clarky, one of the local guys, and I invested in a new FDM printer. Some of the new terrain and stuff he's been putting out, we had this discussion briefly about how good FDM's getting. He's been sending me pictures, and I'm like, oh, I actually need one of these home.
Is it a bamboo?
So we invested with him. We got the bamboo. I think it's the P1, which is the single filament one that points out quality. Prints out really good quality. But then he's been putting out such good stuff. I'm like, oh, I need one of these at home too. So I may have slipped and fallen into a bamboo X1. And bought one the other day, so that's on its way, the X1 carbon. So I can't wait to play with that because the quality that comes out of it is very nice, you know. And because it's far cheaper and easier to work with, it might be easier in the future to do like thematic boards or even thematic events or thematic rounds, because we can just get the terrain out so much easier, or bits and pieces.
So when you're talking about like the higher quality, does that represent itself in you won't have like the print lines as much, or it's a much smoother?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very, you know, you can almost get to the point of not having the print lines now, particularly on these higher end machines. So I'm also considering though that with it for work, fiddling with it and getting like a 3D scanner and being able to like do customized things for, you know, if people need small things that might be braces for wrists or hands or feet or something. And I'm just going to have a bit of a play with it and see what we can do.
Because that's one of my big purchases for 2025 is once we're in the process of reorganizing our garage, is I want to get into 3D printing, I think, a little bit. So I've been looking a little bit at the resin ones and, you know, of deciding, you know, which a resin or FDM. And it sounds like they're both good. It's just, what are you trying to print?
Exactly. I think still for me, I know, you know, someone put this up that it's getting better. I still don't think FDM is good enough for models, for mine most of the time, particularly the scale of the models we're working with. But it's pretty good, but you'll still see lines more than what you do on resin. I'd prefer resin every day of the week for models, for sure.
Going on what you just said too, I mean, if you're doing terrain that's like heavily textured like a tree, you have a hard time even seeing the lines. They probably are there, but my eye's not good enough to pick it up. I mean, this stuff coming off the bamboo is just, it's pretty awesome. And so that's maybe, I'll jump into what I'm doing in the hobby. I haven't really been doing much. Been doing a lot of work lately, but Mike has recently printed out 3 or 4 tables worth of terrain. I literally had to do a double take when he dropped it off. I was like, wait, is this resin? I mean, the buildings look like they were printed in resin, and they're really, really high end. But yet, you could just pick them up and you could just tell that they were a little bit more robust. You know, a little bit more impact resistant than you would get on some of the resin stuff. And even the cleanup and stuff is, you know, obviously a little easier on the FDM stuff. So that's what I've been working on. I've been working on terrain. I'm working on a table for Chase that he won at last year's Slow Girl Challenge. And then we're working on doing a bunch of tables for the shop so they have some terrain. So, you know, I think hobby-wise, hopefully we'll all get more time. And what I don't want to do today is talk about where we are with the hobby challenges for the hobby commitments for 2024.
Because
I'm in really bad shape and I don't want to talk about it. This makes me feel bad. So with that, let's jump in and talk about feedback and engagement. First up, if anybody knows how I can see the podcast comments or reviews on Amazon Music, let me know. And another recent thought, you know, the bulk of our Apple podcast reviews, we have like 77 of them here in the US, but there are a lot of them are really old, like 11, 12 years ago. So we'd love to get some new reviews. And on that note, we did just get one new one. It is from Venom Wolf, V-E-N-M-W-O-L-F. And it says, being a new player, my name is Josh, and I listen to the podcast on a daily basis, either at work, driving, or when painting. I've learned a lot from the podcast and learning along the way. This community is the best I could be in, and it really does feel amazing to be in it. Love the podcast and cannot wait for more content. Josh is a local player here in Memphis, and he's a nutter. Like, he's only been playing for, I don't know, let's just say 3 months. He's already listened to the entire back catalog of Countercharge. I didn't do the math to confirm if you could actually physically do that.
I do not understand how that's possible. What a madman.
Next, let's jump over to Podbean. We got a comment from, I think, Ian Kane, but on here it says Ashmara. Glad you enjoyed my topic suggestion. And that was in reference to the fireside chat from last month. And then next, let's jump into Spotify. We got lots of fun-filled comments on Spotify. First up, we have a comment on our October fireside, and that is from Alistair Vowles. If Mantic want to grow Kings of War, they need to drastically improve model quality. In the wider community, their models are viewed as a joke that look 20 years behind the times. Some people like Mantic models, but the majority don't. Not even within the game, seeing an all-Mantic army isn't that common. Throw a rock at any 3D print artist online, and the quality is better than Mantic. They just aren't competing. Models sell before rules. Good comments, bad comments, we'll take them all. I think what this one does neglect, though, is that people can be attracted to a game for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's the model range. Other times it's the rule set. You know, I think if you look at Forces of the Abyss as an example, there's a lot of people that even before the rules were out, they were just buying it based on the models. There's others that were like, I'm going to hold off. And when they saw the rules, that's when they jumped in. You know, but in terms of models, people also buy models for a load of different reasons. Is it the design aesthetic? Is it the cost? Is it the accessibility? You know, are they readily available in their store? You know, is it the preferred format they want, physical versus digital? My opinion here is that if Mantic keeps making models like they have for the last 4 or 5 years and continues to support 3D printing while also getting their products into wider distribution, that they're going to be fine. I am curious, guys, where he's playing, because he's saying it's not common to see an all Mantic army.
That's the more bizarre bit of the comment to me.
For me, too, that's a little bit of a strange comment because, you know, at Kings of Memphis, which we've ran for the last 4 years, about half the armies are Mantic armies.
We've got Mantic armies at every single event, about 25% at Clash of Kings at least. I mean, yes, we've been beating the drum of improve your model quality, right, to sell your models. But I personally don't believe it's as bad as Alistair's saying in terms of their model quality. It's been coming up, you know?
Yeah, it's a little doom and gloom, right? There's some kernels there that are right. And you bring up a good point, Rob, around availability. And also I would add to that availability is consistency. I think that was one thing is where if you took the best of Mantic and they started producing whole ranges at that level, I think that conversation would be a lot more harder to have of their models aren't great, because they do have a lot of great models. It's getting it up and down the line of a model line, and then also making all the stuff that they have available to buy. But I mean, I think that's something they realize as a company they want to do better. I mean, we've had people on, you know, talking about other ranges, whether it's MCP or Conquest or whatever, a lot of other companies, smaller companies doing quality, you know, really high-end models. So I don't think that's lost on Mantic, right? Of the whole Field of Dreams, build it and they will come, you know, make good models and it will help people get into the game.
The next comment we've got is on our Painting Happy Little Trees episode. And Daniel Garnett just said, I love my scale 75, super matte. It's a dream and looks great. And I guess, Jeremy, that means we need to be working on the sequel.
Well, yeah. And now I've purchased the entire War Paints Fanatic range from Army Painter. And I've been painting almost exclusively with those paints. I absolutely love, love, love them. So that's my new thing. And yeah, we'll have to do a return. Talk about paint all day long.
I'm highlighting with one of their purples right now after your episode, Jeremy. But you getting into the whole range. Look at you loving your new sugar mama life, hey?
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
No comment, but yes.
No comment, but yes.
All I can say about that, and the people close to me know, karma turns around sometimes in your life.
Yeah, good on you, mate.
You know what I mean? So I'm going to ride the karma wave as much as possible.
I thought you were going to say something like, the people closest to me know, it's not like I ain't working for it.
let's just say I don't miss any appointments with the doctor.
Well, next up, we've got a comment on our post UK Clash of Kings catch up with Steve Hildrew that Matt recorded. Daniel again said, Steve did an amazing job. I'm praying I get to next year's Clash. I've already started the next army. And then Major Meister says, Steve, the people who drank your alcohol were not Swiss. They were Austrian.
Yeah.
And next up, another comment from Alistair, this time on our Clash of Command Dice. Command Dice won't attract new players. Models attract players. And Mantic models are widely viewed as a joke by the larger community. Hard as it is to hear, that's the truth. Industry leaders and 3D artists are 10 years ahead, and Mantic aren't gaining nearly fast enough. Modernizing a rule set, it fine in good, but if your model range looks like it was released in 2000, you're not attracting people any more than usual. Evolve by all means, but be brave enough to address the main issue. To the Command Dice ability to attract new players, I think Vern's response from the initial Command Dice Fanatic post sums it up pretty well. To all the haters, the game needs more spice. Recently switched back to the old world, not because it's a better game, but because people play it. I would struggle to get a couple of guys to come out and play Kings of War. First, the old world game day I hosted had 10 guys with half the amount of effort. Now I have to be picky where I post invites to keep the numbers reasonable. Kings of War needs things like Command Dice. It has to get more interactive and a bit more random. Contested magic phase, more wild charge units, more random attack units, maybe war machines that have a chance to supercharge and do extra damage and blow up. Let me be clear. I like Kings of War, super rule set, but it does not appeal to the masses. My area would struggle to get an event past 10 participants. War Machine comes back and it gets a consistent 15 to 20 turnout at their events overnight. It's crazy. Give Mantic the freedom to jazz up the game a bit.
I think for me with the first comment is, you know, I think you always get into tricky territory when you present an opinion as a fact. In terms of opinions, the vast majority of people we interview on this show, they might find Kings of War in various ways, but they keep playing it because they like the rule set. I do agree that models will attract people, but rule sets can do it equally as much, particularly after someone gets to play it. And I've literally had multiple people go, oh, they're bringing Command Dice into Kings of War. You know, I want to give that a go again now. You know, it's easy to think the opinion's right if you're shouting in an echo chamber. You know, there's people play games for lots of different reasons. You may present an opinion so strongly that the people around you just agree with you, you know, and some people just won't want to disagree. But there's lots of reasons that people will play a game. I certainly hear a variety of reasons. So I don't think it's one thing that's going to, you know, kill, destroy, or attract people to a game.
Well, that's it for the comments from this month's Fireside Chat. You know, just a reminder, we'd love to get reviews, comments, whether you're a fan or a hater, from wherever you listen and engage the podcast. So that's Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and if I can figure out how to do it, Amazon Music. When do you guys want to jump us into the vault?
All right, with that, let's have a look at what the vault's offered us this month. And so we've got back to the fantasy offerings this month. It's more Kingdoms of Men ships, isn't it, Rob? And we've got some more upgrade parts and then the Dwarf Vanguard models, which are cool. They're really nice. I mean, if you're talking about sculpts, these Dwarf sculpts are really nice. If you're building a rank and flank army, sure, probably not enough variety, but you can fiddle with them in Blender or something if you wanted to create some different poses. So the standard Dwarf release was obviously in October. And then in November, there was just, basically a continuation along that theme. We had a couple extra of the ships and then the Abyssal Dwarf upgrade parts, Abyssal Dwarf, some of the characters from the vault. But both the Abyssal Dwarf and the dwarf stuff is just really nice. I can't remember. I think it was on the last show we were on together, Rob, I was talking about, you know, not having like dwarf stuff for the Northern Alliance, even though I quite like how they could play in the list. Now, I didn't want to buy the Mantic Plastic Dwarves, but 100% I will print some of these to run as Northern Alliance Dwarves. Yeah. Have you had an opportunity to look at the pictures, Jeremy? Like, I know you don't have a printer as yet.
I think the Vanguard itself, all the releases that they had from Vanguard were really good from a design aesthetic. I thought the Sisterhood, the new upgraded Sisterhood were great. The new Dwarves that came out were great. There was a lot of really good stuff from that release. And these are perfect. Like you said, doing a full army would be tough, but I bet you could take the 6 different sculpts, do some heads, arms, and definitely make a couple regiments if you wanted some dwarf clan warriors in your Northern Alliance army. I think I may steal that idea from you if I ever add them in to do these, to make them a little distinctive. And I like that they have that more sort of armored, you know, like snow, cold. They feel like they could be out there in the extreme elements, but I'm just hoping this is a good preview for maybe we'll get all the Basilean Vanguard stuff onto the vault too, is what I'm hoping.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
It's been a great couple months. We got a Kingdoms of Men fleet from Mantic directly as opposed to buying them from Warlord Games. So that's cool. But then in addition, this month, man, I don't know if you guys noticed, like, they got the command bits for the Abyssal Dwarves, but then there's a spellcaster there. I don't think that guy's ever existed before. I've never seen that model before. So I'm assuming that's an alternate sculpt, which is awesome in my book.
Well, and you never know. Could it be a cheeky sign of what's to come? Will we get a little bit of new stuff?
You know, the Mantic Vault, we've been talking about it a lot. You know, those of us that have been there from the beginning, you know, I looked, I'm only paying like $5 a month because it's like an add-on to my companion subscription, right? But currently the vault is sitting at 10 British pounds per month. That's like around $13. And so I guess if you weren't playing multiple games, maybe there's an argument that maybe you just buy, pick and choose. But if you're playing multiple games, I don't know why you wouldn't just jump in. I mean, in my mind, if I'm paying $13 a month for this, if I can print 2 to 3 of the models, then it's paid for itself at that point. 3 of the models that I'm actually going to use. And we also need to remind people that there is a Facebook group for the Vault. It's called Mantic Vault Facebook. There's a lot of just community discussion on the Vault there. They also run their painting competitions there. Clive will put his sneak peeks there. So if you're really engaged and interested in the Vault, I would highly recommend jumping into the Mantic Vault Facebook group. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. We'll take a quick commercial break. And on the other side, we'll jump into our topic of the month.
I'm Steve Hilder, and you're listening to Countercharge.
Welcome back to Countercharge, and now let's jump into your comments for the topic of the month. And our question was, are you a narrative or competitive gamer, and what defines that description for you? I love the ambiguous nature of our questions, the fact that we didn't give them the definition of narrative versus competitive. From the responses, it's apparent there is not a consistent definition for narrative as there is for competitive. Some folks think narrative is the same thing as casual. I kind of define narrative is really about the story versus competitive, which is about the win. That's how I break it down. And when you look at all these responses, and there's a ton of them, you know, we got about 40-ish% say they're narrative players, high 30s say they're competitive. The rest fall in between. So with that, let's get into your comments, and we'll start with Josh Edwards. I would have to say competitive. As a new player learning the game and playing has progressed my interest in the battlefield, I do like stories and writing them and drawing, but play Trident Realms, learning the story and everything makes me look at my list every day wanting to make it better. For the first few months or weeks, I will be competing on the competitive side of things to where I can have a good list, especially when doing events because I'm in it for the win.
Got a comment from David Musgrave. I'd really like to play more narrative games, but due to real life, the actual games I play are mostly at tournaments that I specifically schedule into the calendar. Aaron Kingman, I'm mainly drawn to the game for competition, but I do love a narrative.
And then we've got Max K. I'm equally drawn to the game by aesthetics, not story, as much as competition, which is, you know, a nice good point there, Rob, about what you were talking about. You know, aesthetics, Max makes the point of differentiating there, I guess. Aesthetics isn't necessarily narrative. And Adrian, As a rule of thumb, I tend to build armies and list narratively, but play competitively. That said, I still really enjoy narrative games. They just don't happen often. And I think we saw that in Adrian's, you know, rock piles and building the story that he had a lot of fun with in the Slow Grower.
We got Danny Graves. I enjoy both, but I don't have a local group that do campaigns narrative with. So again, sometimes the style of game that we love is not always the style we get to play, because in the end, we want to play games. So sometimes you're morphed by what environment are you within. I do lots of writing, and that gets the story aspects of the game out of my system, says Danny, and just enjoy competitive gaming at tournaments at least once a month and build up a great set of friends. So even competitive games aren't that competitive. Well, I just want to really briefly, competitive doesn't mean a-hole-ish. You can have tight competitive games and still laugh and have fun. That's one thing for me when, you know, we didn't say in the beginning, like Rob said, what we think is competitive and what we think is narrative. And I think for me, that's one thing. Competitive doesn't have to be a dirty word. That some of the best, most fun games I've ever had have been quote unquote competitive. But Danny says, I've been to competitive events for other games and it wasn't always pleasant. So if I'm competitive, it just depends on the game and the opponent. So a bunch of good stuff in this response to digest.
Based on Danny's response to Command Dice, I mean, this post was a bit older. He probably doesn't enjoy either anymore.
Well, that's true. I was taking this as a gem unto itself.
Friend of the show, Ben Stoddard. I'm definitely a narrative player. I want to improve the ability to play narratively with Kings of War, as I think there's a lot of cool stories in there to be told. The world is new and has a lot of developing lore. It's ripe for new warlords and conquering heroes to stamp their place in the world. Yeah, one of the things I always wish I had more time for is a good story-based campaign with a map. You know, I can't wait to delve into that one day. And then Hank Dutank, competitive. Most of what people play are symmetric tournament scenarios. Narrative rules like sieges, magic channeling, or the actual narrative scenarios don't really seem to hit the table.
Next, we have a comment from Mark Zielinski, and hold the presses, this is going to shock you. But what Mark loves most is narrative play. I have played way more narrative games. I am a bottom table player. I love Mark's always being his authentic self. But I love to make it to tournaments to play some games and visit with friends. So great answer from Mark.
Sorry if everyone heard a really loud noise. That was me falling off the chair with surprise on Mark's comment.
Troy Hill says, narrative, but there is no local group for me, so I'm stuck with tourney play.
Bob Salt, competitive. I enjoy going to tournaments to play and meet new people, see different armies, and check out the other area metas out there. And then Nicholas Michelonis, it's a way better feeling to play a casual, relaxed narrative game with a tightly written competitive game system compared with a tournament-esque Game of Millimeters national-level game in an amateur-written, fluff-oriented rule set for casuals. He's taken us all around there, Nicholas, hasn't he?
I love Nick. Nick Michelonis, he's one of the most interesting guys. Like, he's very soft-spoken, and you'll have a conversation with him, and then you'll realize, has he been winding me up for 35 minutes in this whole, is this whole conversation like a long con to like, is he messing with me? I mean, it's just the way that he is. Definitely a cool guy. Dojo. He's in the Texas Dojo tournament, but always have great games against Nick. Jesse Garrett. I honestly don't know how you would play narrative in Kings of War. Would be interested to hear more about that. That's a great question. I think it would be really focusing on, I guess, what you do outside of the rule set itself, right? Like designing a map campaign or coming up with your own intrinsic or non-symmetrical scenarios. Because I think there is a way to play Kings narratively. I mean, we've had stuff in the past, but what do you think about that? Would playing Kings narratively require you to step outside a little bit of the, you know, inherent rule system?
I think what you said there, Jeremy, is probably the main point. It's what you're building around the game, right?
Yeah.
Because obviously you're not going to stop using the rule set. So even in sieges, it's about, I think it's probably what's the changes to the scenario that make it a little less symmetric? Or, you know, do you say that, oh, we're playing in this region of the world and that we know that in the fluff there's not this kind of, you know, there's not this kind of creature there or whatever, so you wouldn't have that as part of your list. Or it's about how do you let the world of Panathor influence your game using the existing rule set is what I would say.
And I know, like, in the Pacific Northwest, Ryan Munsell, at some of his events, they tried one year where one of your units would level up during the event.
Oh, during the event. That's cool.
Yeah, during the event. So after each game, you'd get a certain amount of whatever, you know, upgrade points, and you would pick like a unit that throughout the game would change and upgrade. So it's like they're gaining experience during the actual 5-game tournament.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's lots of different ways to do it, but that's one way they did it. Rem Paradis Lavallier. Sorry if I pronounced your name wrong. I'm going to bring a really optimized and well-thought list to a tournament, but you can be sure every single unit in my list will have a name and backstory. This, to me, is kind of where I feel like I fall, Matt, which is I'm always trying to play competitive, right? But in my head, I have a canon about my army, you know, and I have a story and a basing theme. Or I kind of feel like this is my sweet spot, is a little bit of both, maybe. And then Asante Russ. I put together an army that interests me. I then make up characters and write narratives from the games I play. So I guess more narrative. So it's like from the games, like that one, unit that survives against all odds, it gets promoted, you know, or it gets painted. I always would do that. Whatever unit did really well when I was building an army, it'd be like, you're getting painted next, buddy.
Yeah. I think, Jeremy, what you mentioned about like where you might sit, we even heard about just at the start of this episode, right? You still like to put that, it might not make you, and this is the thing about there not necessarily being definitions, it might not make you a narrative gamer, but you have a narrative that goes with your army.
Right? Exactly.
So yeah. You have, you know, said my basing is around, you know, this because it represents, you know, this kind of little town and where it might be situated in the realm of Panathor. You know, I think we have a lot of people, and I think this is what the comments are showing, a lot of people who like narrative elements to their play, even if they prefer more competitive gaming or there is a narrative element somewhere behind their army, even if it is just in the basing. So moving on, we've got Robert Pitts. I build narrative armies, but I want to be more competitive. Stephen Devenish, given the two options, I'm competitive, but my main driver to play Kings of War is more experiential. Try to make a unique list work or play with an interesting living legend, etc. One reason I love Kings of War is that so many ideas can be viable given how well the game is balanced. And then David Fanning, I'd love to play narratively, but the only way I'm managing consistent games is at competitive events.
For better or worse, that is true, right? Events really can be the lifeblood of a community, right? It's what you're working towards. It's something to force you to get things done, a really like a benchmark, you know, for better or worse. We have Alistair Vowles again. I need to find out where he lives because Alistair needs like a big hug, I feel. I need to go to his where he is and like bring some sunshine into his life. And I just need to be like, bro, are you okay? Is everything going okay? Because here he is in his ray of sunshine self. He's definitely competitive. Personally, I don't think much of Panathor fluff. It's failed to draw me in like other games have. In my mind, I'm basically playing Warhammer, right? But with better rules, which I think that's true for some Kings of War players who are ex-Warhammers. They're still playing Warhammer in their mind. They're just using a better rule set. That being said, narrative games have very little interest to me overall. I'm a tournament player at heart and love the competitive nature of the game where I can bring the filthiest lists I can match up with the best opponents can bring. Narrative games just feel to me like new to your list for their sake. He wants to bring a gun to a gunfight, right? And it's that spectrum, right? Which is some people are like, I don't care how filthy it is. I'm going to bring it. If it's in the rules, then it's totally good. And then other players, maybe they get their jollies from trying to take something that's a little bit more special snowflake and compete at that higher level. So again, it's this really cool idea as we go through these things. One of the things that's rising to the surface for me, Matt, is narrative and competitive. It's not like a one sentence explanation of what those things mean. They mean different things to different people, right?
100%.
Felix, my main man, I'd say competitive, but mostly due to only having so much time to play. And again, getting most of my games at tournaments. So that ends up being a huge portion of my games. He says he does miss events like the International Campaign Day. You know, I hadn't really thought about the International Campaign Day. That was like a blast of the past. That was back when Chris Kapsner and Mark Cox and others, right, where there would be a campaign and everyone would be playing across the country. You'd be in different time blocks. And I remember that was back in the day. Were you into Kings when they were doing that?
Yeah, I was into that. The time zone, I think never suited us that well. I mean, Ben tried to keep it. Ben Stoddard, who's already commented, we read it out, he's commented, tried to keep that going for a while. And I'm not sure what happened. I think probably it was probably just a lot of work and maybe didn't see quite the levels of participation they were hoping for. But maybe if Ben listens to this, he can drop a comment on the show and let us know what ended up happening in that space. Was it an interest thing from people, or what was it that kind of led to us not seeing that again? Then we've got Stephen Tuck. So Tucky says, between the two boxes to choose from, I am competitive. I am driven by social and hobby ahead of competitive, though. The competition is where I catch up with a bunch of friends and show off my hobby. That said, those that know me know I play competitively on the table and love a real tight, well-played game. It's just not the main reason I turned up on the day. One of the big draws of the competitive events like a Clash or Masters is seeing all my mates from around the country that I only see at these big events. And I think Steve makes a good point there, Jeremy, is like some of my best games are tight competitive ones, right? Because the reality is every time, whether you sit down casually or narratively or competitively, is that there's a winner and a loser. When a game is close, there's competition. And I've always loved the competitive aspect, even if at times I'm pushing more towards a narrative element.
Yeah, and I think there's certain things that about playing a competitive game that aren't bad, like wanting your opponent to move correctly, right? Or mark their units before they move them. Or a big one is, you know, playing tight, like when you're pivoting. Are you pivoting off your center? Are you doing the electric slide pivot, right? Where your combat reform, you start to pivot, and next thing you know, you're like 4 inches. You're like, bro, that's not really off your center. But it's just, again, you can have some of those best games I've had. Are you, like you said, where it's coming down to millimeters and it's like, oh, I need a 4-inch overrun, but I only get 3 inches.
Yeah.
People who want to play by the rules, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. It can be positive. So Steve Evans, he says, for me, though I like narrative play, Kings is my only competitive game. I play loads of other games which are more narrative. Oh, so interesting. Kings is great for competitive play as the rules are so clean and streamlined, so I don't need to get any practice games in beforehand. This is the reason why I'm always a bit nervous when they add new rules to the game. This is interesting for me because I resonate with Steve on this in that Kings, for me, is my favorite tournament game. Whereas when I play Marvel Crisis Protocol, I don't even care. I want people to throw cars at each other and Wolverine's going to kill the whole. You know what I mean? It's like maybe you can be both narrative and competitive gamer. You just find the game that best fits that sort of desire for you. Like, I'm going to try to be competitive in this game, whereas this other game I'm not going to take as seriously, or I'm going to focus more on the story. So that's an interesting to be different focused in different game systems.
Mm.
Craig McCartney says narrative every time. I come from an RPG focused background, right? That makes sense. List building and stats don't interest me, he says. I attend and run the odd tournament, but I don't do well in them as I don't want to face players who take winning seriously. So just wanting that more casual environment. Again, that sort of element of narrative, some people seeing that as maybe more casual, but.
Okay, and then on to Ian Kane. Playing a game with someone and having a fun time is always the goal. Adding some story into the mix is just the cherry on the top. I play most of my games at home against my friends, so generally play some games to learn a system and then throw together some sort of campaign mechanic to tie them together. At present, we've just started a Kings of War Armada campaign tied together with an evolving narrative, and you can have a look at that. He's Fishpond Wargames blogspot. That's kind of what we talked about, Jeremy, how the narrative elements are probably built around the rule set.
I never did it right back in the day, but that was always the dream when they, you know, to do like a campaign where you have your naval combat, you have your 10 millimeter giant army, you have your regular size army, and then you have your skirmish of, you know, run a campaign that combines, you know, all those different elements into one. Like, I saw one of the coolest narrative 40K events I played in. It had a 40K game going on, and then it also had a Space Hulk game going on. So there was a squad in the Space Hulk that was trying to turn off this planet annihilator thing. And then, so it was like taking all these sort of different elements, but combining it. That's where I think that game really, really shines. 40K is in when you think about narrative, but I digress. So the Mecha Sturgeon says, I'm a narrative hobbyist and a competitive gamer. I will design an army around a theme and paint what I think looks cool, even if the army list isn't competitive. Example, only one king for my elves, no air elementals in my verdant nature army, etc. However, as soon as that army hits the table, we're playing a game which results in a story, not a story made into a game.
Yeah, I like that. Results in the story, not a story made into the game.
Yeah, so interesting outlook there. Scott Blanchett says narrative. Scott Sally, apologize if I pronounce your name wrong. He says, for me, competitive play is building a list with the sole purpose of winning the tournament. Crush your enemies, you know, see them driven before you. Narrative is building a list of units you like or want to see on the table, then creating a story or background and playing to have fun. Me, I started out attempting to be competitive, but have since changed to a more narrative approach, playing for fun, writing short stories or bat reps about games or tournaments. If I win a game, okay. If both sides have a good game and have fun time, even better. My hope in every tournament is to have fun and win at least one game. If I lose, I want it to be a close game, one that has laughs and memories for all. I have found that I enjoy tournaments more and have less stress since I switched to a narrative mindset. So, oh, yeah. So some really interesting thoughts there.
Then we've got our one of our New Zealand friends, Mark Otley. Build narratively or more accurately some sort of theme. For example, I'll take armies that have Naiads or River Guard, but not both, but I play competitively. Because Kings of War is pretty balanced, I think the distinction isn't that great, though some players will try and max whatever seems to have a bit of efficiency edge. Dylan Scribner, it's both for me, depending on the definition of narrative. No matter how tough of a list I'm trying to make, I always have to have a theme and my own custom backstory behind the army in order to really get into it. If we're talking strictly gameplay at events, though, I'd have to say I lean competitive, although I do look like a good campaign day every once in a while. Juan Carlos Rubio, to me, playing a tournament is a question of sharing the hobby, not of winning. Considering this, I would say narrative.
Chase Thompson says, I don't play especially narrative games, but my philosophy towards the game is certainly more narrative than competitive. I come up with backstories and lore for all my armies. I make lists more based on fun and looks than optimal min-max lists. Generally, I make about half of my list purely based on the models I like or units that seem fun. Then select the second half of it based on what will work well with the units I previously chose. I'm typically very narrative focused until the game starts. Then I will try everything I can to win outside of actively toxic, poor, you know, mannered play. It's as important to me that my opponent have fun as it is that I did, and it's certainly higher on my priority list that we both had fun than I won. I really love his comment, that idea. We've talked about social contract, which is win or lose, you want both players to have fun. And I like that idea of, you know, I'm going to take what I want, but then once I'm playing, I'm going to play it as hard as I can. Roy Quinn, I'm a casual gamer. I just want a fun weekend night experience. I want a bit of fluff, an immersive fantasy battle with some high points. Winning or losing doesn't matter much, and reducing the game to a mechanics test of skill just doesn't do it for me. Surely playing chess is a better option if that's all that's desired. However, my slight concern with narrative play, in the sense of folks who want to tell stories, is they often forget no one is really that interested in their homebrew lore outside themselves or maybe their gaming group. Got to be careful with that. It can get a bit like boring people with stories about you, telling you boring stories about their kids. That is pretty funny.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah, that is a good
one. Such a good comment. Who is this Rory Quinn? I don't know if we've heard from Rory before. Maybe we have.
I'm going to deploy my general. His name is
Heinrich Schliemann.
Redbeard Ironbark. He was the seventh commander on the Day of Lore when he defeated the orcs at Ramshackle Path. And you're just like, dude, bro, come on.
Or you bring up something and they'll be like, actually, the third book that was written by Mr. Ben Stoddard, you know, on page 83, You know, it actually says this is what supports my argument.
Oh, according to Michael Rafi, who had written about the free dwarves, actually. But...
You set us off, Rory. Well done. And then I love this next comment because I haven't actually read it yet, but I know that Alexi is a Queenslander from Australia, and it's just, you know, I'm just enjoying seeing that there is a Queenslander who can read and write. So I enjoy narrative play, but however, I found it doesn't happen much within Kings of War in my local community. Kings of War has a very tight rule set that is well streamlined and simple and can be played out at a competitive level very neatly compared to other similar games. Locally, at least in Queensland, this has resulted in a good 3/4 of our active gaming population being primarily competitive players who play mostly at tournaments as the game is well suited to the environment. For these same players, if they want to do more narrative stuff, they tend to play other systems that feel like they're more designed for that. Blood Bowl, Dead Zone, The Old World, Dreadball, Horus Heresy, which, yeah, it kind of speaks to your point from earlier, doesn't it, Jeremy?
Yeah, it's like, do I want to make a round peg fit in a square hole or vice versa? Or do I take my square peg and play the square peg game? Just an interesting idea, you know. The Squirmin Vermin says, I had to think about this one for a while. Well, we all know that about Squirmin, right? He's a very introspective fellow. I'm a competitive player, but not competitive against other players. I'm competitive in the sense that I want to master my army. I'm testing myself. My opponent isn't my enemy. See, this the Squirmin, he's like a scholar.
Is this Squirmin or Splinter?
The Squirmin Vermin is like the Aristotle of the rat world. My opponent is not my enemy. They are my sparring partner.
She's on, she's off.
Our friends after the game, there must never be any hard feelings because all of our little toy soldiers are going to get back up and fight again next weekend. All that said, I did run an Escalation League this year, which was narrative in nature. We had a fantasy map of Wisconsin. Oh, you had me at Wisconsin with all the cheese, right? And all 10 players claimed territories, pen treaties, and had little border wars. It was a lot of fun. Okay, we got to get Squirmin Vermin and Rory. We got to get some of these fellows on a round table because we got some really interesting insights into the world and life here. So. Jeremy Bear says, I am drawn to factions based on theme and somewhat the aesthetics. Why play League of Rordia if the halflings don't get a run most of the time? List building and exploring the world is definitely narrative. Hitting the table is competitive. Time constraints mean playing tournaments, prepping for tournaments, or helping other people prep for tournaments results in playing competitively a lot of the time, right? However, I do enjoy introducing and teaching new players Kings of War.
RG Allen, I don't play narrative games, but I am a very narrative-oriented player. My armies, as many can attest to, are not based on what is the nastiest, most deadly spam I can take, but on a mix of units that can perform multiple tasks. I've been a middle tables masters player. I've been on table one in multiple smaller tournaments, but it is because I don't play nasty that I rarely finish at the podium. I admit, I go for thematic and narrative armies, and I'm not changing that. Brings the MacGyver armies of the world.
Mr. Jeff Bodine, I'm undeniably competitive in pretty much everything. However, I do have the occasional narrative sticking point that I like to maintain. I also do some mental gymnastics to narrowly shift the alignments of my army because I like playing good guys. So that's like, you're the good. Well, that's got to be... Squirmin Vermin, right? His ratkin are like the Dow of rat, right? They got to be good rats. I've just convinced myself. Eddie Barr, I've always built my armies on a very narrative basis, but because the tournament scene is so good in the UK, I've started to become more competitive curious. Oh, interesting.
Lastly, we've made it through all the comments, is Andrew Hawley. I would like to say neither. I am under no illusions that my armies are competitive, but when I decide to paint an army, I like to have at least one unit of everything. Yeah, that's not unlike how I build armies, actually. I very rarely, the Northern Alliance, actually, even with that, I didn't. At points, I'll build towards a list if I've got something coming up. But a lot of time, I'm picking up what I want to paint, you know. I really love that, actually, in the end. I kind of thought, I wasn't sure about this, what kind of output we'd get and how good it would be to do it. And I don't think we needed to provide a lot of, you know, stuff around it. The comments really speak for themselves, but I think what we saw then was this really interesting spectrum on how people perceive narrative or competitive. And, you know, the giving you only two options was reasonably deliberate, right? And what we saw, wasn't it, Jeremy, that probably a lot of people bring some narrative elements even to their competitive play, whether that be the backstory, their theming. And I think that makes sense based on what lots of people say they like about Kings, right? They like multi-basing and telling a story on the tabletop. And that's a narrative element.
It's very much a spectrum, I felt. You know, I don't think it's you're either A, B, or C. What I took from people is that a lot of people are a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. And that it really does, you pointed out two key points, which is the clean rule set is great for competitive play. And what can be more thematic than the ability to multi-base? And so I think a lot of us are narrative players in Kings without even realizing it. If you do a multi-base, to me, that's like inherently narrative. If you're building a multi-base, you're telling a story with that unit.
All right. Well, let's slide into a commercial break and we'll be back with some thoughts on Clash of Kings. And then after that, we'll give you an update on the podcast and we'll wrap it up.
This is Skullface. You're listening to Countercharge.
Welcome back to Countercharge. And guys, I thought it'd be fun. We've been talking about Clash of Kings now for a couple months, maybe share a few of our initial observations and maybe even throw in a prediction or two. Well, let me kick it off with Command Ice. In terms of Command Ice, you know, having a game be more attractive to more gamers is pretty much a good thing universally. And more importantly, the growth of the game and the improved accessibility that comes from that. So it's been generally positively received so far.
Yeah, I think it's been generally positive, Rob. It'll be interesting to check back in with some of these. You know, there was a post popping up the other day, I think, of, oh, you know, I played my one game with Command Dice and now here's the definitive thoughts that, you know, will not change ever. You know, we see with lots of changes in the games, there is no way that you conceptually can implement it to its maximum and best usability on its first go. It takes a while. It takes seeing how other people use it. It takes using different armies to see how they use it. In the main, there's been positive, but then, you know, some of the outcry, again, with like opinions posed as facts has been frankly ridiculous. Is it that different to our usual outcry at, you know, per Clash of Kings book with various changes? Probably not. Probably not.
It's normal this time of the year.
I would argue actually maybe even less than usual.
Yeah, maybe. Less armies have been impacted, right? So I've been thinking about Command Ice a lot, and I figured I'd just share my all too early initial thoughts on them. And, you know, for me, Command Ice bring a mechanic that connects Kings of War to other Mantic games, you know, like Vanguard and Dead Zone, Firefight. But, you know, specifically for Kings of War, the way they handle turn seven is I'm in love with it. I really love the fact that it leans into, you know, that question, are you playing for turn six or are you playing for turn seven? Because as a reminder, you don't replenish your command dice pool in seven. So whatever you rolled in six, you can spend it all in six and you have nothing for seven, or you can save some, reserve some, and have it available for seven. So I love that. But more to that, you know, commands can do many of the same things that magical artifacts, spells, and auras can do. And I'm hoping to get rid of some of that redundancy. But commands are also a little bit more tactical in their application. Units can be given commands regardless of line of sight, range, or having to be purchased for specific units at the start of the game. You know, in my mind, this makes them more flexible than artifact spells and auras. Essentially, you're paying the resource cost exactly when you need to use it. However, there still are limitations on commands, you know, in terms of unit types and keyword restrictions. And they're certainly not as powerful as auras, just in the sense that, you know, an aura can affect multiple units, whereas a command can only affect one unit. But the more interesting thing about commands is that they're less predictable, especially the higher pointed ones, you know, as they're generated by a random resource turn by turn rather than paying up front during army creation. Now, you can mitigate this by purchasing additional dice. You know, everybody gets a free red, white, and blue, which generate four per turn. But if you think you need more than four dice, you could buy additional dice. But keep in mind that if you buy those additional dice, they're tied to a specific hero. When you lose the hero, you lose the die. Also, it's important to keep in mind in this discussion that most commands are four or less. I don't think everybody will agree with my next point, but I firmly believe it. Commands will bring out more interplay. And I'm going to give one example. With the increased availability of Ferocious Charge, because there are several factions now that have commands, it will increase the value of Scorched Earth. Not only are you hindered, if you now have the ability to stop Ferocious Charge, I think there's going to be some play there. It begs the question, where do Command Dice go in 4th edition? Matt, you touched on this. Right now, it's a bolt-on mechanic, and it feels like it, right? So I'm looking for the dice to be more integrated in the Kings of War. You know, I would like them to bake in the command dice into specific heroes. This could be an alternative way to adjusting heroes rather than just changing the points or changing the rules, right? Like, oh, this guy's overcosted. Cool, we'll give him a free die, and that might justify the cost. I would also like to see them add the ability to reroll a command die. Because, you know, you're rolling these three die. It would be nice if you could reroll one of them. And it could be like an innate ability like they have in Vanguard, which in Vanguard, you could just reroll one of your command dice per turn.
Give it to the general of the army, tie it to characters.
Yeah, exactly. Going back to my point before, because command dice do things that other things can do, like magic artifacts, spells, and auras, sometimes they can be redundant. And I want them to find ways to reduce the overlap. I don't want three different ways to mitigate being hindered. I don't know, guys. What are your thoughts on command dice?
I think it's a cool idea. What I would like to see is people just try them, you know, get feedback. If you were to say off the top, what would be one change that I would explore? I like how Firefight does command orders where different heroes have specific orders. So there's some generic orders that the army has, but then there's certain commands that only certain characters have. I think that would be a way to add a little bit of flavor to the hero slot choice, which I think in general in Kings of War, the hero slot choice has always been sort of underwhelming. But I don't want it to be like Character Hammer, right, where it's one hero killing half your army. But maybe you have a certain command order that you want, but it only comes with one hero that then that hero, it flavorizes that hero a little bit. I like how that's how it's done in Firefight. You have generic orders and then you have orders intrinsically linked to specific commanders.
That's really good, Jeremy, because I think there may be orders in the future that maybe people might perceive as too powerful. But if you tie it to specific characters, right, and that's like another limitation, maybe there's a keyword requirement. You only have it one time from this one character. I mean, there may be ways to restrict a more powerful command. I like Firefight too, the way that there are generic faction orders and specific character driven ones. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on dice?
I think we just got to keep in mind that, you know, it is currently a bolt-on, you know, that the full realization of this is probably going to be better. I mean, one point I can get on board with the potential negative side is I do think that there is the chance that if you're not from within the ecosystem of the Mantic games, that adding things like this can add a level of complexity that, you know, makes it a little harder to pick up and play, and that it can play into, again, the better players better, and that potentially there will be some elements for players not expecting it, particularly at the start, that feel a bit gotcha. I can certainly understand that point of view, but I totally agree with someone, I think had said it earlier in the piece, is about Kings, is that it needs this little bit, I believe, it's just an opinion, that this element of the game there's elements of the game that have to be a tiny bit less predictable, that your opponent doesn't know exactly what you're going to do based on movement. And I think that's what command dice are going to provide us.
You know, there is the risk as well that command dice do increase the skill gap, right? Because the better players are going to have more options, and it's potentially going to be more tools that they can leverage against opponents. Whereas maybe the people that are more casual won't have the same skill set to maximize the usage of the dice.
You look at competing game systems, right? Almost all of them, the heroes have some sort of supremacy ability or special spell, or in a lot of those popular games. So I think people like having heroes matter. They see themselves in their army commanders, or, you know, especially coming off this discussion around narrative or versus competitive. And I think in Kings, usually maybe we have a couple heroes that are pretty good, but in general, they're kind of an afterthought, I think, sometimes when it comes to what's actually happening in the game. So I think adding a little bit more agency to heroes, a little bit more power, making them a little bit more dynamic, making them a little bit more interesting, I think that is in tune with elements that are present in other popular game systems. So when you talk about, well, how do you know if this is going to add players or not? Well, if you look at other game systems that have people playing it, having a little special sauce for heroes is pretty consistent in those game systems. So I think bringing that into Kings based on, you know, how it works in other systems, I think makes sense just logically to me.
let's jump in and talk about the different factions, right? Especially the ones that are either new, updated, or have been touched in some way. And let's start with Forces of the Abyss. I think there's going to be a short-term gain from people leaning into the regeneration grind of Forces of the Abyss. But long-term, given the popularity that seems to be happening right now with the Abyss, plus the popularity of existing regen armies like, you know, Abyssal Dwarves, along with commands that now give additional armies the ability to give 5+ regen to max defense 5 units, I think means that folks will be building in tools to deal with this long term. So in the short term, I like where the Abysses are sitting. But I think long term, people are already thinking about it, and I think there's going to be answers. I don't know. What are your guys' thoughts on the Abyss?
I think that we see that with changes that we perceive as powerful all the time, right? It is for a while, and then people learn how to deal with it, and they build around it, and the meta evolves, and it changes, and you know that's the whole point. I really like it. I mean, from a completely non-data-driven perspective, because I don't have the data, it feels like this has been one of the most popular releases in a long time from both models and rules perspectives, and like every man, woman, and their dog is building an Abyss army.
I'm in the Matt Crozier hipster camp where like, man, if everybody's playing it, it's not special anymore. I want to be special.
Yeah, I'm 100%. My order, I got the notification that it's on the way. I probably won't build it for a while because I'll wait and see what's on the table. Plus, I've finished my Northern Alliance. I have never played my Halflings at a tournament, so I want to build up a few more of them. At some point, I will. But yeah, it feels like a really popular release. From my reads of it and the, as usual, the release we got that we went through isn't necessarily the completely final copy, so there might be some things that were slightly changed. But my read of it is it didn't feel OP, not compared to other things.
No, I mean, I think you have a couple different ways to build that army, right? You can lean into the regen, or they have two great speed elements. The Berserkers are great. And I think the Cav, they now have one of the better Cav options. Fearless Defense 5 regening Cav is pretty strong.
Backed up by Nagari.
What I like is now there are more than just one or two builds, right? So maybe we'll see a little bit more diversity. And I think the change to Sacrificial Imp was huge. I think it was a massive change. So, and just so many people have got that. I think we're going to see a lot of them being played here in 4 or 5 months. So if you're not playing Abyssals, taking a look and seeing how they play probably is pretty smart right now. And thinking about in 5 months from now when all the new Abyssal armies are painted and I'm playing Abyssals 3 times in a tournament, what do I need to know and how to beat them?
I'm almost hesitant to bring this army up, Matt, because I know what the response is going to be from our buddy here. But we should probably talk about the Twilight Kin a little bit, right? I know it's going to put him on an edge.
Let me just go put my armor on.
Right. So I'm okay with the changes. I think in most cases, they're correcting mistakes. You know, like the points for the Void's Gifts, or, I mean, come on, the Blood Hex had to change, right? And in some other cases, I think they took the edge off, you know, like the piercing on spells or units having 2 out of 3 keywords. The only list that is not viable anymore is the Void Skiff spam, because what is it, 10 points per regiment, I think, is what the cost went up.
Which is significant at that points level.
Often, like Jesse Berglund, who ran that, would also run it with Impaler centers, right? Which now the Impalers are not quite as good. I think they got pretty close. The original set buffs for TK were way out of control. And what we got was a much more reason, which happens in playtesting, right? You start at one point and you either go less or you go more based on feedback. So I think it's pretty close. Only thing that bums me out is the Impaler losing the keyword. I don't know. It's cool. And I know a lot of people have talked about whether some of the Night Stalker elements are better now. But to me, I'm playing Twilight Kin not to play Night Stalkers. I'm playing Twilight Kin to play Twilight Kin. But they still have some of the best infantry in the game, right? From the Fleet Wardens are amazing. So I think that it probably still will be a good army. It's just, I think now there's going to be maybe some new builds. My issue was not that Twilight Kin had some units that were too good. I think the issue was some people didn't like how they felt to play against. And all I was trying to say was, if an army is unfun to play against, it doesn't intrinsically, inherently mean that army is overpowered. It means that it's just some people don't like playing against it. And this, I think, was a little bit of both, right? It both had some elements around it that were inherently frustrating to play against, i.e. piercing, no cover, lightning bolt that can be cast into combat, right? That also weakens you, you know, plus maybe some units that when they're max synergized feel just like no, there's no weakness to them. I base my opinion on having played the army so many times and having a win rate with what I would expect to have with, you know, an army like that against top players. But in general, I think plus or minus 2 or 3%, I'm down with pretty much all the changes, you know, except for the I probably would have made all these changes, but not changed the keywords. But again, that was, I was a little bit, wanted to be not quite as bullish on the changes as maybe others.
I think we have to acknowledge, Rob, that Jeremy, you know, he has toned down the rhetoric on the changes.
It's not as inflammatory as I'm used to.
Changing a lot at once is problematic, right? Because there is no way that you can have, in the short spaces of time that I know they work with, that you can really appropriately play test all those changes and how they interact. So I can totally get the whole, you know, did it really need to lose that keyword? Yes, it's still very good. But, you know, I think some of the changes, it'll be interesting to see if some of them did go too far. There are a couple of little buffs as well. To be honest, I still don't think we're done with weakness. Weakness is still really, really good. It's still undercosted. You can basically turn off your opponent's shooting. It's long range, no cover. Just bring in cover for spells, you know. I don't think the move on weakness, and that's not just Twilight Kin only, you know, Abyssal Dwarfs and whoever are accessing it now in that can access it in multiples in particular. That's where it's problematic, is the accessing it in multiples.
Yeah, so it should be interesting to see how they do, right? Because this last year, good players who played Twilight Kin did well, right? So it's, and that's another thing. When good players play armies and do well, is that because they're good? Or is because the armies, you know, there's so many different threads in the tapestry of balance, right? And we're never going to get exactly there. I'm with Matt is, if you change too much, it's too, you've turned too many dials on the soundboard to know, well, maybe this one or two dials would have been enough. But when you go to like five dials, maybe you go too far. But we'll have a year to test it out. And plus, it's like, you know, there's a new edition coming. You know what I mean? So it's like, my desire to stop playing them is rooted a little bit in their power. But to me, it's more of, I like being surrounded by positive energy and love and people. And people hate playing them.
I'm one of them. I hate playing against them.
Exactly.
Because it's like, everything I want to do to shut you down, in most cases, you have an alternative.
You have a tool for it. So that wanting my opponent to have a good experience, that's really one of the main elements of why I'm not going to play the army anymore. Because when everything's kicking and you're playing Twilight Kin, you annihilate your opponent and they can't.
I'm going to paraphrase what Jeremy just said. He's decided he's not going to win on easy mode anymore. That's what I heard. Is that what you heard, Matt?
I don't want to bait Jeremy too much. I always do that. I always do that, you know. I'm not like Jeremy spoke about how, you know, you can have a conversation with Nick Malonis and get to the end and be like, have you been winding me up for 35 minutes? Unfortunately for Jeremy, I'm just smacking him in the face with winding him up most of the time.
You know, it will be interesting to see, though, when fourth edition hits, if it's a greater air elemental situation where they've now went back and added, they thought, okay, losing two taxes was a bridge too far, and they've adjusted it back to 9. And maybe we will see some, or in the case of Twilight Kin, you know, Matt, you bring up a good point. You know, maybe piercing wasn't really the problem. It was the fact that you have a 24-inch range with no cover penalties.
Well, yeah, I mean, after playing tons of games against Tom, that's really what he wanted. He wanted it just to take cover. He didn't care as much about the piercing. It was the no cover, because you can, if something can get cover, you have a play against, right? But if something doesn't take cover, you have no counterplay to it, right?
And particularly with its range, you know, there's actually not that many spells that are that long a range. And it just happens to be one of the best ones.
But I think everyone knows the boats were undercosted. They're too good for what you got. Blood Hex probably was a little too. So, like I said, a lot of the stuff makes sense to me. You know, I think the other big faction that got hit, right, was Ogres. And that makes sense to me too. Their characters were just too good. Siegebreakers. Why take anything other than Siegebreakers and Warlocks?
Let's jump in and talk about Ogres. I'm 100% with you, but I will say something different than a lot of people's opinion. They're the same power level they were before.
Their power level doesn't drop at all.
No, it doesn't drop at all. It's just a different way. And so, you know, the discussion about the potential shift from Siegebreakers to Warriors or Hunters, I don't see it as a problem. In fact, you're going to save 15 points, right? Because they went down to speed 5, but they are 5 points less in the Horde. When I look at it as an Ogre player, I'm trading one defense to the front for those three units with the ability to gain rally one or two on several units. And I take that trade every time because the bane of my existence of Siegebreakers is 15-17 nerve. Yeah, sure, I'm defense 6, but Crushing Strength is all over the place, right? Like, it's not that big a deal, right? And the fact that you're 15-17, I wavered a lot. And now if I can be, 16-18, or how about 17-19 on a defense 5 unit, I'll take that. And people might be thinking, well, wait, how do you get to there? Well, the Paymaster is now an upgrade to the Sergeant, which costs 15 points, and it gives you Rally 1 for Merc, which is essentially everything in the list besides Chariots and Siegebreakers. And then in addition, you have a command that you can cast on a unit that is called Early Payment, which gives a unit Rally 1. You know, you have two sources of Rally 1 in the list. It's not going to be hard to get 3 or 4 units pumped up to Rally 2. The other thing about the Siegebreaker thing is if you're theoretically taking less of them, because maybe not so much for the speed 5, because I don't think that's an issue. You were counterpunching anyways. It's really more the concern about the Warlocks, right? They don't buff the Warlocks anymore. Maybe the bigger issue to me is, you know, you're losing one extra Crushing Strength on 3 units, right? But number one is you can still take Siegebreakers in the second line. You're still going to have your freaking Drain Life 8 if you want it, because there's still plenty of stuff in the list that's going to pump it up. People forget that there are sources of Bane Chant. You can certainly take the loot. But, you know, if you're taking Nom Nom, he's got a freaking pretty infallible Bane Chant.
Mm.
I don't see much of an issue there. You know, another piece of this that we need to touch on is their other faction command, Show of Strength, which is +1 brutal. I don't think it's settled in with a lot of people yet, but you're already brutal 1 across the board, every Ogre unit.
Yeah, that's been the main thing I've looked at.
The Mammoth has brutal 2 and has the ability to give brutal +1 to another unit. So now with this command, if you're taking the Mammoth, you're sitting at, you know, one unit with brutal 2 and another unit with brutal 3. Which is pretty good. God forbid you even think about putting Kuzla on the table. You're changing the dice by 4. Now, I'm not saying it's a good tactic, that it will work long term, but it's literally something to think about. Because if you're changing 4 on the dice, pretty powerful stuff. You know, when you're talking about a brutal or 1 on the dice, you're really talking about like 3 extra attacks, right? That's kind of the grand scheme of things. And so, yes, if you are losing the Crushing Strength, but now I'm adding more brutal, it's like, well, I think it washes. For me, guys, warrior units, or if you're not living in the shooting area, you take some hunters. You know, I think it's, you're going to have unit strength for days. You're going to be rallied up.
And they do have the counter for shooting anyway in the stealthy bubble unit. So
yeah, the boomer chariots for sure.
It's just a top tier faction.
All it did was maybe take less Siegebreakers. That's all it did.
Yeah. You know, we still play a scenario game and all your heroes score and none of mine score, so right off the bat you're already at a, you know, and all your stuff's just high quality, man. It's high value, it is a solid army before, which is shown. You can see it in the results. Ogres dominated a lot of events.
Well, I mean, they finished 1-2 at Master.
Exactly.
We're getting Justin Robbins on List Builder. You know, his list with the Giants, I think that's really, and Hunters, I think that's the list that I'm most intrigued to see how it plays out. Cause you know, now you've got different speed threats with the rally, you know, that can mitigate the fact that the Hunters are only defense 4. I'm just going to say here, Ogres will win Masters next year too.
What I was going to put out there is I think those, what at face value seem very simple changes, actually makes it a way better designed list instantly. It is almost the best designed list in the game now. You might not get, like the theme feel of your Northern Alliance or your Twilight Kin or whatever. But it is just about the best list all round now from those simple changes.
And we didn't even talk about the Matriarch upgrade, right? You know, with the new scenarios, being able to have units that redeploy is going to be a positive thing when you have scenarios that are really incentivizing you to spread out or be in different parts of the table. So I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but I'm very high on ogres. I think they're still good. To Jeremy, what Jeremy said about Twi'lekkin, I don't know that the warlock thing is, you know, that's the same, right? You're still going to have 24 drain life.
Oh, I'd still take 3 every day of the week.
And there's some good generic orders around easing out low to mid dice pool variance, right? Which is the which is always an issue when you have these ogre type units, is you have the one round of combat where they flub or they get stuck or whatever. You really need to be able to punch those. And there's a lot of good orders around that also that I think is going to go really good with ogres. Like the one order where you get to reroll a combat, right, is going to be really nice with, because you have that one key ogre combat where you don't want to bounce because you're going to get something in the flank or whatever. So I think also just the orders in general, like you said, are going to be really beneficial to them.
Yeah, actually, speaking of new scenarios, Rob, I forgot to say right at the top of the show is that on the Kings of War Australia website, the Blackjack has been updated for the new scenarios. And in my understanding is that it could be in Companion on the launch date of the rules in Companion 2.
Is that November 11th is what I heard?
November 11th, yeah.
Well, what other armies do you guys want to talk about that have made changes? I know I was a little surprised dwarves didn't take more changes just because they're so strong.
Like we talked about in the Scrying Gem, we think that that's a really top tier army right now, dwarves. I'm still waiting for halflings to make their breakthrough too. I think just when you talk about just list design, the halfling list is just so well designed with its internal balance, and there's so many just high quality units. I'm just still surprised that we haven't had a, you know, more halfling breakthrough, but I think we'll maybe have some short king action this next year. Dwarves and halflings doing well.
I've been the last few Clash of Kings, and this is as a, well, previous dwarf player, I guess. I haven't played them for a while. I've been really disappointed in the last few clashes with dwarves in that they basically just keep getting better and better. I don't know if it's because there is, like, dwarf players are generally whiny pricks, you know, that are always complaining about what they don't have. But the formation, its first iteration actually then got better. You know, they just get more and more, and, you know, ordered march. Some of the stuff that's going on with command dice just makes them even better. So, and the reason I don't like it is I just don't want to see tournaments dominated by one or two, you know, factions. I just really hope we don't get that. I hope I'm wrong, but dwarves have so many good tools now. You know, their shield breakers are so good, and dwarves have so many options for defense 6, good options, you know, and that you can just not get through. So I don't know. I've been a little bit disappointed that they didn't get a little bit of a touchdown somewhere, but we'll see.
All right. Well, let's take a quick commercial break. On the other side, we'll jump in and give you a little snapshot of what's coming down the pipe with the podcast. We'll be right back.
This is Sean Vilmont, the best orc player in the mountain region, and you're listening to Countercharge.
Welcome back to Countercharge. I'm glad to say, guys, our backlog is now being cleared. I did want to welcome our two newest contributors. You guys have been hearing him for the last couple months, but Nathan Arnold has taken over handling our lore episodes, specifically the Lore Masters Library. And Jordan Nichols has been helping out with the hobby episodes. So I'm really, really keen to have more involvement from those guys. Please don't forget you can help the show by sharing it with the community. It tickles me pink every time, like, we're in a chat and someone says, they ask a question and we have an episode covering that question. And one of our listeners jumps in and says, well, here's the episode. That's really great, organic support for the show. Rather than just rah, 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 it's a great show, give them a specific use case. Hey, you want to learn about orcs? Here's the Orc Army Review. And also give us a review. When people do a search for Kings of War in whatever podcast aggregator they're using, we want to show up in those search results.
Or even Fantasy Wargaming. You know, we want to be coming up a little bit higher so that, you know, people might have a look. You never know how people are brought to the game.
That's a good point, too. I always think of it as the faithful, but you're bringing up a good point, too, in that we want to be available to be received by people that are maybe Kings of War curious, you know, looking into the community rather than from within. Next, we did want to mention that our December fireside will just be rolled into our 2024 year in review, and we will have a topic of the month that we'll share during that 2024 year in review. In terms of schedules, we have the community building series. We're in the process of tackling the next stakeholder in that, which is your friendly local gaming store. You know, we're going to look at how they can support and grow a local community. We have List Builders upcoming. I've already recorded Simon Brand and Jed Courtney out of the UK. I've already recorded Chuck Dudick out of the US. I'm just waiting for Justin Robbins to get back with me, and we'll get him recorded as well. We have a long list of people we want to get on for that. We have a hobby episode that's coming up talking about, you know, how rule systems can impact your hobby. And we got a great painter that come to Kings of War from AOS to chat with us about that. We have a new player perspective episode. You know, we mentioned Josh Edwards a couple times. He gave us a review, and he also had a comment in the, from the topic of the month. But his enthusiasm is infectious, so we'll be bringing him. And then we got Army Reviews, guys. I've got Forces of Nature, and Matt's got Rodia, because those are the two that you said you want to see. And we still got Ogres. What's going on with Ogres, Jeremy?
Yeah, it's on the list to do. And then also there's been some, we had mentioned on a previous Scrying Gems episode about wanting to do an episode about how to intentional practice, intentional list design. How do you take a list through its initial stages, practice with intent, and build upon that list? So kind of like a list builder studio, but instead of looking at one person's specific list, we're talking about list design and practice in general. So that's on the agenda to do. So now that I'm back, you know, from my month away, definitely going to sit down and think about what episodes to get scheduled for recording in November and December. So.
And we do have another Lore Masters Library coming up in December, which is Rise of the Celestians by C.L. Warner. If you haven't been reading the book, get to it. You still got time. And as I mentioned, we will have the year in review, which is always a lot of fun. And if, I don't know how many years we've been doing it, but it's been a lot.
Yeah, all I know, there's one common theme. Jeremy going, nah, I didn't make it.
To be fair, I think I'm going to be the low man on the totem pole this year. It was a bad year.
I don't think any of us will completely make it this year, that's for sure.
And you know, Matt, we should mention, we still owe the community a final hobby challenge wrap-up live stream.
Yes, yes. Now that Jeremy's back, we'll have to do that. We said we're going to make him pick live, too. We're not going to give him notice.
Do it live. Do it live. We're doing it live.
We're doing it live. You know, we said that part of the fun of this hobby challenge would be that seeing our positivity friends struggle with having to pick someone over another live on camera. Also, I'll have the Masters live stream, but we'll turn that into, as in a list live stream, and we'll turn that into an episode, and we might release that later in the week.
What's the over-under on the number of wings that are going to be in Luke Schaefer's army?
Ooh, number of wings. So not flying units?
Nope, number of wings.
Ooh, that has to take into account. Is he putting minimum models on the base? Probably. I'd be looking at over and under 18, I reckon.
I'm going to say 21. That's my guess.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I don't know what he's playing, though. To be fair, maybe he's playing an army like that doesn't have a lot of flyers. But I know he's been painting up a lot of Northern Alliance birds lately, right? So that's why I was thinking maybe. Well, let's just close out. You know, we do have a topic for next month. We try to shift back and forth between gaming, hobby, or community focused. And so the next one is more community focused. And our topic for December is, how do you weigh the comfort and convenience of playing Kings of War at home versus the growth opportunities of playing at a public space like a club or your friendly local gaming store? When this episode drops, you will see a post with magnificent artwork generated by our illustrious artist, Matt Crozier. And please give us your comments. And it'd be amazing if we get the same amount of comments that we got from this one. I mean, there was there 60? I don't even know. It took a long time to read them all, I can tell you that.
Yeah, for sure. And loving the level of engagement on these. And to be honest, I think, I don't know about you guys, but I get a lot of just positive feedback about the Firesides in general. So I think people love hearing the, you know, the topic of the month discussion. And of course, you know, everyone just loves hearing my opinion, right, Rob? That's all it's what it's about, really.
Thanks for joining, and to remember, always keep counter charging.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by commenting on the Countercharge Kings of War podcast Facebook group. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.